Years ago, when I started attending a Unitarian Universalist church, I found myself chatting with the clerk at a Trader Joe's. They're always the friendliest people there, aren't they? "Where are you headed next?" she asked. And I told her I was going to a church event. "Oh, what church?" I told her. "Oh, yes," she said. "I went to a Unitarian Universalist church once. I loved the people and what they stood for." She paused. "But the day I was there, they kept talking about Transylvania, and it sort of freaked me out." "I'll have to give them a try some other time." Yes, it's the T word we are touching on this morning, Transylvania. Reverend Eric Cherry writes, "I admit that I have an impulse to protect people who are new to Unitarian Universalism from the T word. I'll perform linguistic gymnastics to avoid uttering it. I'll refer to Western Romania, a former part of Hungary, Eastern Europe, anything but the T word. I do this because of the fear that Americans and potential new UUs carry so much fictional baggage about the T word that they'll run away in either fear or laughter if I utter it with seriousness. That may be ridiculous or cowardly, but I admit that I do it." Now, as for me, I'm convinced, there we go. I'm pretty sure Bram Stoker had the Transylvanian Unitarians in mind when he wrote Dracula. Who else would have been so averse to crosses, right? That may be the one place where Transylvanian folklore and Unitarian reality meet, except when I play Dracula, but that's likely the only place. For the real story of the Edict of Torda is a great story. One we don't tell too much, most likely because it happened so long ago and so far away. But here we are at the 450th anniversary this month of this proclamation of religious freedom. So we would be derelict in our duty if we didn't tell the story of Francis David and King John Sigismund, the only Unitarian king that ever was, and of a country where one could believe and worship as one pleased, despite the fact that the royal family were of Unitarian faith. It didn't make the entire country turn to be Unitarian. And for one brief, glorious moment in history, the bells of freedom truly rang. And then we fast forward 450 years to today. And I wonder whether humanity will always have the tendency to divide itself into groups in conflict. And perhaps this is something in our nature. Social identity theory says that a person's sense of who they are is based on group membership. These groups that we identify with give us not only a sense of social identity, but also are important sources of pride and self-esteem. And we can even increase our self-esteem by discriminating and holding prejudiced views against groups we don't belong to. Henri Taillefer proposed that stereotyping comes out of a normal cognitive process of grouping things together. But in so doing, we tend to exaggerate the differences between groups and the similarities in things within the same group. In social identity theory, the in-group is the one a person identifies with, and the out-group is the one they don't. And they may even find themselves discriminating against people in that out-group in order to elevate their own sense of self. The human need for elevated social identity can thus lead to racism, sexism, and, as we are discussing today, religious discrimination. Currently, we see this tension alive and well in this country. The understanding of who Muslims are, the cross-denominational conflicts in Christian communities, anti-Jewish sentiments, the rise of mega churches with their emphasis on guns and xenophobia. And of course, Thursday, we had the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services create the Conscience and Religious Freedom Division. And that allows healthcare workers to refuse to perform services to people based on their religious beliefs. And this potentially affects LGBTQ folks, Muslims, you name it. One of the reasons I received a master's degree in the emerging field of interfaith work this past year was not that I'm particularly interested in all honesty, an interfaith were as a subject for intellectual or creative exploration, I'd be more inclined to go get a degree in Victorian literature if that were my goal. It's that I see the emerging need for we as a larger culture to begin to identify and deal earnestly with the work of engaging our differences in a healthy way. And if we don't, as we saw this last Thursday, I don't know where we will end up. Stephen Prothero's book, Religious Literacy, What Every American Needs to Know But Doesn't, great book, really, really encourage you to read it, explores the sad irony that the United States, despite the number of people who identify as religious, is essentially a nation composed of religious illiterates. Frighteningly, Americans know very little about the religion they claim to practice. Many times, Protestants can't name the four Gospels, Catholics can't name the seven sacraments, and Jews can't name the first five books of the Bible. When it comes to religions beyond the Judeo-Christian tradition, Americans have even less knowledge, with very few people even able to name Buddhism or Hinduism as one of the world's five major religions, forget knowing anything about them. Why does this matter? Because, Prothero writes, religion is now emerging alongside race, gender, and ethnicity as one of the key identity markers of the 21st century. So if this is true, we know from social identity theory that this means there is the potential to continue to demean other religions in order to elevate the status of the so-called in-group. And history has shown us that ignorance plus bigotry equals oppression. And if this is the case, then religious freedom, something we can take for granted, could be at stake. And once one freedom slips away, others are likely to follow. But I don't want to ever be smug about work like this and suggest that it's only the larger culture that needs to do this work. Even we, progressive people of conscience on the far end of the liberal spectrum of religious community, can fall into our own version of assumptions and stereotyping. So this was made clear to me a few years ago when I toured Boston's Freedom Trail. Has anybody done the Freedom Trail in Boston? Yeah, it's fascinating, right? It's a line made of bricks in the street, and you follow it through the streets of Boston, going in one historic building, visiting one historic site after another. And the story that is told is one of America's freedom. Certainly the story of the American Revolution and freedom from the British, but also one that gestures back to the Edict of Torta and its emphasis on religious freedom. For these historic sites represent the values of religious freedom that the Puritans who settled in New England, and these are values they didn't always live up to, but nonetheless, out of these people, the Unitarians eventually formed. And one of the buildings you visit along the Freedom Trail is King's Chapel. It's the oldest continuously operating religious site in the United States, and King's Chapel began back in 1686. And inside this historic church, it's a grand example of colonial architecture, you'll find King's Chapel's own Book of Common Prayer. You see it right there. And it's a descendant of the Anglican Book of Common Prayer. They use it every Sunday. You attend a service at King's Chapel, be prepared to listen to biblical scripture, be prepared to pray every Wednesday night, and on Sunday mornings, Holy Communion is celebrated with your choice of grape juice or wine. Besides Christmas and Easter, special services throughout the year include Ash Wednesday, Palm Sunday, Maundy Thursday, Good Friday. Do you know what kind of church King's Chapel is? Unitarian Universalist Church. So indeed, while the ways of New England Unitarian Universalists can seem very foreign to us here in Southern California, we are an odd species out here in Southern California, aren't we? Wonder what they think of us. They are absolutely a member congregation of the Unitarian Universalist Association, certainly much older members than we are, and they, with their emphasis on Christian tradition, represent one side of the spectrum of congregations under the UU umbrella. We have other congregations that lean toward paganism, Buddhism, atheism, humanism. The 500 congregation I previously served in Northern California had a strong Jewish UU identity group. Visit modern-day Transylvania, and you will experience Unitarian high church much as it was hundreds of years ago, including the separation of men on one side, women on the other. Men and women even enter the sanctuary through separate doors. I say this because as open-minded as we Unitarian Universalists like to think ourselves, I had to reassess who we were and who I was as a Unitarian Universalist as I visited congregations across this country. I've been guest preacher in Texas, Illinois, Maine, Florida, Oregon. Each time I encountered theologies, rituals, customs, attitudes that surprised me. Each time I realized I had to expand within myself the umbrella, the theological and cultural umbrella of what Unitarian Universalism is. And while we as a larger faith movement have truly embraced the religious freedom that those in our history fought for, and I think that's evidenced in the fact that our umbrella is so broad, within our individual congregations, we can sometimes forget the spectrum of theological possibilities that are practiced throughout this faith movement. We can feel like our particular location here in Southern California, sharing space with a Jewish synagogue, is the only viable way for Unitarian Universalists to be. We can decide that this congregation is primarily humanist or atheist without necessarily exploring the theological perspectives of the dozens of new members who have joined in the past year. That sense of social identity is strong. So here's the thing about freedom. Freedom starts at home, religious freedom especially, because until we dealt with our baggage and biases about other religious groups, until we've made sure we have created a welcoming spiritual home for liberal people of conscience who fall under the UU umbrella, we can't even begin to do the work to heal the religious intolerance we're seeing in the world. And there are two main reasons for this, in my estimation. One is spiritual, inward-looking. The gist of it is that if we hold prejudice in our own hearts and minds, we will always be blocked from seeing the larger picture of what is needed out in the world. If I decide that as a gay man, too many Christians have oppressed my life, therefore Christians are bad, I don't want anything to do with them, then I cut off my ability to really see the dynamics at play in the larger world. My vision will be colored by my resentment and my anger and fear. The other reason is practical. The truth is, while this congregation right here has been growing, and we are mighty in our strength, courage, and resilience, we remain a small minority of progressive thinkers. And you put all the Unitarian Universalists in this country together, and we are still a small group. We are. But if we are able to get past our religious baggage, we can actually work with others who think like us on these important social issues. Sure, they may worship differently. They may hold different theological beliefs, but we need each other. We saw that at the Women's March yesterday. We need to be able to partner with progressive and maybe not as progressive Christians and Muslims and Jews. And one of the people I work with in the Fullerton Interfaith Ministers Group is a leader in the Mormon Church. And together, we've organized these classes in world religions, the ones I'm telling you start on Tuesday night. Our hope is to begin chiseling away at that religious literacy problem that Prothero describes in his book. And once upon a time, not that long ago, would I have thought I would be doing that kind of work with someone who identified as Mormon? It's not likely. In interfaith work, I constantly find myself checking my assumptions about other religious groups. I know that not all of you have those opportunities to work directly with other faith groups, though I would like to change that for us. But I will tell you that I am constantly surprised. If we're getting our portrait of other religions from the internet or television news, and how can most of us help but not get it that way, we are only getting a portion of the story. So here we are, 450 years after the first European Declaration of Religious Freedom, something we should be very proud of because it came out of our Unitarian movement. And because Unitarians and Universalists have over and over again pealed the bells of freedom throughout history. But as we know from history, and as we know from Francis David's tragic end in prison, where he died after King John's successor, who did not believe in religious freedom, put him, we know that religious freedom is never a given, nor is any freedom for that matter. As Prothero writes, from the time of the nation's founding, the success of the American experiment in republican government was rightly understood to rest on educated citizenry. To keep the bells of freedom ringing, we must learn to ring them ourselves, not simply listen to their echo as they possibly fade away. We must be vigilant, looking out for signs from our country's leadership that the erosion of religious freedom has begun, and perhaps most importantly, for this is the foundation of everything we do, we must look within ourselves. Have we become rigid in our conception of our own social identity? Where are our prejudices? What religious groups do we need to learn about or make amends with? What places of wounding do we need to find healing from? So may this day be one of celebration. 450 years in the making. And may it be a day of reckoning. One that looks at least 450 years into the future, a future where people can continue to responsibly search for truth and meaning across the horizon of possibility. For without that search, there is no freedom.